Welcome to Dr. Creepin's Dungeon. Walls have ears, doors have eyes, trees have voices, beasts tell lies. Beware the rain, beware the snow, beware the man you think you know. Three terrifying tales of terror for you this evening. Later on, we have I competed in a game show where the contestants faced their worst fears by Grotesque Penguin. We round off with It's in the Shadows by Cosmic Dawn. But we open up tonight with Me and the Boys Went Hunting in the Woods by Crone Johnson. Now, as ever, before we begin, a word of caution. Tonight's stories may contain strong language, as well as descriptions of violence and horrific imagery. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin. The moon illuminated a patiently waiting figure under the rain. A large, smudged silhouette approached it from the distance. Horses panted as the wooden wheels rolled through the mud. Once close enough, the ornamented wooden carriage came to a halt. Two mounted lanterns showed the coachman tilting his hat. A tall, well-dressed, pale man exited, lifted the figure's luggage, and invited it in. The muffled sound of multiple raindrops landing on the roof made the interior cozy. Dry and sheltered from the cold autumn wind, the tall man sat next to an even paler, middle-aged woman in a beautiful white dress. The figure's visage came clearer as it sat on the opposite side. "You are Lady Hortense, yes?" A blonde woman, pale as both of them, tilted her head. "So I am," the older woman frowned. "And you are Miss Esther. It seems my expectations were too high." She let out a disappointed sigh. "Why would you wear those?" The woman's shirt, trousers and boots emitted a cheap perfume. "No need for the miss, just Esther. Pursuits in fancy dresses end badly." "I understand. But surely you'll change into something more appropriate once we reach the city." "I assure you I will. But I wasn't called here for fashion advice, was I?" "Of course, of course." Hortense's condescending frown disappeared. "You heard of the murders?" "The entire kingdom has. My assignment is to slay the killer." "Oh, if only it were that easy. Most of the city's police are after it. Men have volunteered, and each day we hire more of your sort." She glanced at the pale man. "You, Miss Esther, shall serve as one of my personal guards. My estate, my property, my family. The killer is not to come anywhere near. Obey these basic orders, and you shall receive the agreed assets each month." "I received your letter. I've already agreed." "I enjoy repeating myself. It prevents misunderstandings." An evil smile crept on the woman's face. "Welcome." Carriage entered the city. Each building consisted of wood and brick. Their chimneys let out smoke, indicating the population hiding from the cold night. It passed one of the city's larger pubs. Mugs in their hands, two men watched the rain from inside. Beside their table, a crowd of people sang, laughed, drank, and ate. Each person in the pub was from the working class. Therefore, they wore similar clothing. "All this has made me think." Ralph, a young man, licked his lips. "How are people this happy? Come to think of it, they were sadder before the murders." His older friend Paul smiled. "Oh, I've been around long enough to answer that question. Compensation." What? "Compensation. When it's summer, do you light a fire?" "Why would I? The sun'd be burning my head." Paul pointed towards a group of people standing around the fireplace in the middle of the hall. "Oh, It's cold now, so we light a fire.
I'm not following.
If the cold wasn't here, would we be together around a fire?
I get you.
When something bad happens, we want to feel better. Say, if you get stuck in a chimney, you'd want a beer.
I'd usually want one anyways, but if I get stuck in a chimney, I'd really want one.
Well, when something much worse like murders happen, people need something much better to heal themselves. Each other's company, getting drunk, laughing, basically forgetting about the monster in the streets for a moment, and thinking of the love in our homes.
Ralph rubbed the back of his neck.
I get what you're saying. He took a sip of his beer.
But how can we just ignore it?
I said, forget it for a moment. Dozens of men are currently out there.
Paul pointed at the window. Two men with rifles patrolled the streets in the distance.
Enjoy this little moment you have.
He smiled. Ralph smiled back.
Yeah, you're right.
A loud thud made him spill half of his beer.
What?
The two friends turned around. The songs and laughter stopped. Two men faced each other amongst the crowd of seated people.
One towered over the other and had his sleeves pulled back.
I saw you. I saw your eyes. The other man was much skinnier and looked nervous. No, you're making a big mistake.
He had yellow eyes. He's the monster.
A few others stood up and approached them.
I heard it can turn into a man, a whisper came from the crowd. If it were to choose, we're all dead.
More people surrounded the skinny man.
No, don't do this.
Ralph walked up to the tall, aggressive man.
You're drunk. Relax. This is the third guy you've accused. We're all friends here.
The ones who had gotten up looked at each other and sat back down. The tall man grabbed Ralph by the collar.
And you've protected each one. Which side are you on?
He punched him in the nose, sending him a step back. Ralph punched back, and things quickly escalated to a fight. A group of men sighed and stood up.
Come back when you learn some manners.
Both men flew out of the bar and fell into the mud. Ralph mumbled something under his nose as he got up.
You got us kicked out, you gib face.
Finally realizing his mistake, the aggressive man shook his head and walked away into the rain. Ralph ran his hand through his wet brown hair and leaned on the pub's wall.
Hey, the skinny man walked out. Thanks for saving me. Yeah, that drunk had it coming.
When they let you back in, I'll buy you a beer.
I could really use one right now, Ralph laughed. Yeah, compensation.
He scratched his chin.
Haven't seen you around here before.
Between me and you, I work for a nobleman. Due to the murders, he fled the city, left me without a job. Before Ralph could say another word, his eyes locked on the silhouette of a man. Half hidden behind one of the buildings, he watched them from an alley opposite the pub.
Are you seeing that?
The skinny man turned his head.
See what? There was a man there.
Ralph didn't move his eyes from the alley where the man had been.
I think it's best to go inside.
Together, they walked back in and sat next to Paul.
Your nose is bleeding. You really have to stop getting into fights, he laughed. And who may you be?
He turned to the skinny man. Ralph sat down.
This is... What's your name?
Uriah, and I'm sorry to say this, but I won't be buying you that beer. The skinny man checked his empty pockets. Before they could say another word, a deafening shout made the entire pub go quiet. Everyone slowly turned towards the windows.
That sounded like the drunk, Ralph whispered.
A few of the men, along with Paul, took their hats off.
Show some respect.
Everyone slowly returned to laughing and having a good time.
A loud slam made all the patrons look at the center of the hall. A well-built man in an expensive attire had slammed a stool against the floor. He slowly got on top of it and towered above everyone. "Enjoying our evening, are we? By no means allow the murderer to ruin your mood." His judgmental eyes moved across the crowd. "Who are you to judge us? Go back to your fancy manor, you pansy fist fuck," one of the poorly dressed men shouted. "I am not here to judge those who carry the city. I am here because I shan't let our brothers and sisters die." "Got a hero, have we?" another patron shouted. "Oh, I am no hero, good sir." His expression changed to a more serious tone. "Some of you volunteered to patrol the streets." "So we have. What's it to you?"
"I am also a volunteer." Multiple people laughed when the man said those words.
"And I am here to provide." His eyes moved to a specific patron. "My good sir. Workhouse?" The patron nodded.
"Wife and kids as well."
The man on the stool looked at another patron. The man on the stool looked at another patron, who nodded as well.
"Well, I shan't prolong this. I possess the knowledge of capturing the murderer."
The pub went quiet. He had everyone's attention. Neither the force nor the nobles see offense as a possibility. The force is on the urge of giving up, and the nobles cower in their little pieces of personal heaven. I say we stop being idle. I say we shouldn't tolerate the loss of our brothers and sisters. He got off the stool and extended his hand. "I have resources. Greatly rewarded with coin and fame will be those who choose to join me. You shall be armed, fed, and sheltered."
Paul walked up to him. "And what would our duties be?"
"To join me. To join me in the woods, where we hunt down the murderer."
"When?" "In 3 days."
Everyone's faces became even paler than they already were. Paul licked his lips.
"The moon will be full in 3 days, if the rumors are true."
"As I said, I know how. But I can't do it alone."
People traded glances.
"I give each and every one of you my word. If you follow my instructions, all of us will return as heroes." Ralph walked up, extended his arm, and placed his palm above the man's hand.
"You're the first noble I've seen to come here. I'll join you."
Paul silently watched him for a few seconds, before extending his hand as well.
"I accept your offer."
Uriah nervously approached. Without making eye contact, he placed his palm on theirs.
"I haven't eaten in a while," he whispered.
Two other men joined in. The noble gave the rest of the pub a disappointed look. His eyes moved back to the men. "You are all brave. Tomorrow we meet at noon." He passed each of them enough money for a warm meal and then disappeared into the crowd. 3 days had passed. Our hunting party camped outside the woods, waiting for the moon to rise. Aside from myself and Paul, 3 others were present. Uriah, the man I saved from the drunk at the pub, Cole, one of the 2 volunteers, and the noble who was paying us. The 2nd volunteer never showed. The noble had introduced himself as Sir Gideon. None of us really knew if what he talked of was real. One thing was for sure, though. He believed it was. He vaguely explained that some monk had told him what the killer was and where to find him. His personal scholars gathered information afterwards, which confirmed the monk's story. This noble, supposedly being the only person to know all of this, aroused suspicion among us, but he was wealthy and paid as well. Everyone knew the pattern. A few months ago, the murders had begun. Each night, a person would be gruesomely stabbed to death, and once a month, when the moon was full, multiple people would be brutally mutilated.
People said they'd heard howls at night, that they'd seen it.
It was rumoured the murderer was cursed for his sins, and now takes the shape of a wolf each full moon. Sir Gideon firmly believed in those rumours. He told us of how he tracked the murderer for weeks. Human footprints led into these very woods, and wolf paws on the same path led towards the city. The transformation took time, and the murderer needed a secluded, safe area. The people who weren't hiding in their houses were guarding the city. No one would come here at night. He armed each of us with a torch, a dagger, a musket, and a flintlock pistol. We were given pouches with special ammunition, but aside from the noble and Cole, none of us had much experience with hunting. While there was still light, and it wasn't raining, the weather was cold, so we had a small fire. Cole had his eyes on me as we ate. "So, Ralph, do you have family?" "Isn't that something you ask when you might die?" I slowly chewed the side of a carrot. If the killer were to take the form of a beast, he's said to have mutilated entire patrols on a full moon. A scent hound calmly waited in between Cole's feet. "The patrols didn't have this special ammunition. It should take it down." I looked at Gideon. "It should, right?" He nodded with a smile. "I have given you all my word. I have not forgotten. Follow the instructions and all of us will live." From when we'd met him, the noble had repeated multiple times how all of us are to speak as if he is one of us. It felt strange, though, to eat and talk together. "Brothers, are we well rested and prepared?" All of us awkwardly nodded. The sun had almost entirely disappeared. "Then we shall begin." Gideon stood up. He was the only one of us who carried a sword. "Follow my lead." All of us lit our torches and made our way towards the woods. Even though the forest became denser as we walked, the leafless trees made it easier to see. Cole took a deep breath. "The wind is moving in our direction. Good." The scent hound constantly sniffed. "If we are not alone in these woods, Eva will know." He held the short leash tightly. Uriah waved his torch around in all directions as if something would sneak up on him. "Sir Gideon, the woods are vast. How do we know where to search?" "Oh, the moon still has not risen. The killer is currently a mere man. He isn't capable of moving any faster than us. He cannot be far from the city." The scent hound began to bark and pulled Cole forward. "She found something." Torch in one hand, dog leash in the other, he led the group through the forest. Traversing the woods had become extremely difficult. The danger of slamming into a tree, falling down a pit, or just tripping made running a bad choice. We hastily maneuvered around the multiple obstacles nature threw at us. Myself and Uriah drew our pistols when Cole warned us we were close. We emerged from the trees and found ourselves in a small forest clearing, with a stone well in the center. The scent hound stood on its hind legs and leaned its paws on the well. Cole carefully peeked into the darkness. "Be it the killer or something else, there is a man down this well." He calmed his dog and took a step back. "So the killer lives in a well?" I inspected what seemed to be a perfectly normal well. Gideon dropped his torch in it. The ball of light illuminated the dark, dry interior as it landed at the bottom. From our point of view, we could see an entrance, which led to an underground tunnel. Paul moved his hand across the stone surface. "Why would there be a well here?" Two glowing dots flashed in the dark tunnel, beyond the light of the torch. "There's something down there," I shouted. Everyone, including the hound, bundled up around the well. "I saw it. I saw his eyes. Did you see it?" From all the men, only Uriah nodded. "I saw it too. Something was watching us."
Paul scratched his beard. It must be some kind of animal. Either it fell down and got stuck, or there's another entrance somewhere close. Cole let out a sigh. There's a man down there. Ever's nose doesn't lie. Also, I haven't heard a single animal since we entered the woods.
Gideon leaned against the well and crossed his arms. He thought for a moment before looking at us. You shall lower me down the well. I put my palm against my face.
Are you insane? We have no idea what's down there, nor do we know how big the tunnel is.
Paul put his hand on the noble's shoulder.
I'm coming with you.
I don't know how, but in less than 3 minutes, Paul convinced all of us he knew what he was doing. Uriah and I held a long rope at the top, the bottom of which hung in the well. Uriah's hands were shaking.
Oh, are you sure you can do this?
The noble nodded and cautiously crawled into the well. We watched as he slowly climbed down.
Good evening.
A calm voice came from our back. Everyone instantly turned around. 10 meters from us, half sticking out of the trees, a young woman in torn rags watched us.
Oh, how did your mutt not smell her?
I whispered to Cole. The girl extended her hand towards us.
It's so cold out here. Thank you for bringing fire.
Her whisper was barely audible.
Who's up there?
Sir Gideon's voice echoed from the well.
A young woman,
I yelled back. Paul smiled and took a step forward.
Are you lost?
We could see him holding his pistol behind his back.
Do you know what this well is?
The moment he approached her, she hid deeper behind the trees. We could now only see half of her face.
We can get you home. We won't hurt you.
Paul holstered his pistol. Something pulled on the rope with great strength. A few rocks cracked where the rope turned, slamming me and Uriah against the wall. The rope painfully slid through our palms. We heard Gideon fall. The only thing we could see was something pulling the noble deep into the darkness.
He let out a pain-filled yell, but shortly went quiet. We couldn't see him anymore. Gideon!
I shouted. The rope was gone, so going after him wasn't an option. Now that he'd stopped yelling, we could hear Paul yelling. By this point, our necks were tired from constantly turning from one problem to another. The young woman was trying to pull Paul into the forest. Dagger in hand, he slashed her multiple times, attempting to free himself from her grip. Cole shouted and dropped the leash. All calmness left the scent hound's eyes as it bolted towards the attacker. It tackled the woman down to the ground, freeing Paul, who instantly joined us. The dog dragged her out of the woods. Cole shouted again. It calmed down and ran back to his side. Now that we could see her up close, something was terribly wrong about this woman. The wounds left from Paul's dagger and Cole's hound didn't bleed. Cuts, gashes, and holes in her body revealed black muscle. She blinked and locked eyes with me.
You said you'd get me home,
she whispered as she slowly stood up. Uriah dropped his torch and aimed his musket. The moment we saw what he was doing, all of us jumped back and held our palms against our ears. If there were others in the woods, the deafening shot let them know exactly where we were. Uriah waved his hand to clear the cloud of smoke around him.
Why would you do that?
Cole shouted as he moved his palms away from the scent hound's ears. The shot had launched the woman a meter back. She laid on her back without moving. The gaping hole in her forehead emitted steam.
You murdered someone, I think.
I looked at her closely.
She was already dead. Urai was going through the slow process of reloading his firearm.
I recognized her. She's one of the murder victims. Where do you know her from? A brothel.
We looked closely and saw that, aside from the new wounds she had gained, her body was covered in scars. A long one across her throat stood out the most. I looked around, not knowing what I was searching for.
Oh, what now? Don't know about you, mate, but I'm going home.
Cole tried to clear his ears with his pinky finger. Paul looked at the well.
We can't just leave him. I'm staying. He might still be alive.
I grabbed him by the shoulders.
Paul, it's too late. Our best chance is to go back and gather more people. We should... go back.
A voice similar to the woman's whisper came from the woods. We turned to see the drunk from the pub. He wore rags and had scars all over his body.
Let's go back. It's cold here.
He watched us from behind the trees.
So very cold. Mother, where are you?
A second figure slowly crawled out. This time a young boy.
Cold. Why did you leave me?
A fat woman emerged from the woods.
Cold.
More silhouettes could be seen in between the branches. I frowned and looked at Cole.
If we're not alone in these woods, ever will know.
I mockingly imitated him. We stood next to the well in the center of the clearing. The undead murder victim slowly walked towards us. We lifted our torches and nervously looked for an escape route. Cole calmed down for a second.
Hey, wait. Why are we running? It's a miracle these people are still alive. Shouldn't we get them back to their loved ones?
The fat woman opened her mouth, revealing her teeth, all of which were razor sharp.
Give me your war,
she whispered. We broke into a sprint. I could see Cole lift his dog with both hands and run in a random direction. Urai let out a girlish scream, dropped his musket, and fled as well. Paul and I tried to find the way we'd come from.
While the victims were many in numbers, they were slow.
If we kept calm, maneuvering around them wouldn't be too difficult. Whatever these people were, they became fewer as we moved away from the clearing.
I think they're gone.
We looked to all of our sides. It was an entire miracle we hadn't hit a tree or tripped on a rock. Once I was calm enough, I smiled and faced Paul.
I guess Sir Gideon didn't follow his own instructions. The man died trying to stop a murderer. Show some respect. Yeah, sorry. You're right.
Paul's eyes widened.
What's wrong?
I asked. He grabbed me by the collar and pulled me towards him. One of the victims had snuck up from behind me. It sunk its sharp teeth into Paul's shoulder.
He yelled and stabbed the creature's eye with his dagger.
Blade still in its head, it collapsed.
Paul, are you all right? Definitely more painful than a dog bite.
He put his palm over the wound. I tore off a piece of my sleeve and bandaged my friend.
Oh, Paul, you saved me. He'll buy me a beer when we return to the pub. Come on, keep moving.
We kept on walking through the woods.
Do you think Cole and Urai are alive?
I didn't look at Paul when I asked this question.
We can only hope. We should have stayed together. I think they should be able to handle themselves. Besides, the worst has passed.
The clouds in the night sky tore apart, revealing the full moon. Our torches were no longer needed as the moonlight lit up the forest.
For a moment, we stopped
and stared into each other's eyes. A few seconds passed, and then we continued walking. I smiled.
At least Gideon was wrong about the rumors. Rumours?
Yeah, the ones he told us about the killer. How some believe he can take the form of...
Ear-piercing screams of pain sounded from the direction of the forest clearing.
I looked at my torch. Paul, the torches will only give away our location. With the moonlight, we don't need them.
I hurled my torch into the woods.
Ralph, no, Paul shouted.
The dry branches quickly caught fire.
God, a forest fire will also give out our location.
I grabbed his torch out of his hands and hurled it in the woods as well.
Oh, God. Well, let's hope this slows him down.
Before Paul could say another word, the screaming had stopped. And that's when we heard it. The uncanny howl of a monster. A monster which was most likely heading towards the city to kill.
We moved as fast as possible, hoping we could escape in time. When we get out of the woods, we're still quite a distance from the city,
I nervously whispered. Paul looked back at me and the rapidly growing forest fire.
If we get out.
The trees became fewer, and soon we exited the woods and found ourselves out in the open. The few city lights in the distance gave us hope. The only obstacle in our way was a vast field with no hiding spots. So we bolted.
Ralph, wait up.
We hadn't even passed half the distance when Paul slowed down. I turned around.
Come on, we're almost there. Almost there. Maybe for you. I'm not as fast as I used to be. Go. I'll catch you up at the pub. Remember, you still owe me a beer. Paul, I'm not leaving you. We're getting out of here together. Ralph, I haven't been feeling too well the last few months. I've been getting worse. Pains in my chest. I don't know how long I have, even if I reach the city. You're telling me this now?
I shouted.
You had enough troubles. Do this for me, please. Just go.
I looked back at the forest fire. Burning silhouettes of the murder victims were emerging from the woods. Paul smiled and nodded.
Promise me you'll come back to the pub.
His smile faded. He didn't answer. I kissed him on the forehead, smiled, spat to the side, and ran towards the city. I never looked back.
I ran. I ran as fast as my legs could carry me. I stole a look over my shoulder as I watched the bushes behind me begin to part as whatever was chasing me began to emerge. Before I could catch sight of the beast, I felt my body make contact with a solid concrete wall. I winced in pain as my breath was forced out of my lungs from the impact. I crouched and slowly began to try and catch my breath.
I've got to slow my heart down,
I thought to myself as I began to slow my breathing down and focus on what to do next. The creature that chased me would be on me in seconds if I didn't find a way past this wall. My eyes scanned over the concrete wall that seemed to span for as far as the eye could see. My eyes soon landed on a small hole close to where I was standing. It was roughly the size of a manhole. An ear-piercing shriek sounded behind me as I looked back in horror. The beast was now fully emerged from its spot in the trees. From what I could see in the darkness, it looked part rodent, part arachnid, part humanoid. If that even makes sense. Needless to say, I didn't waste any time in scrambling into the little tunnel. It was barely big enough for me to crawl on my hands and knees.
Heart's beating too fast,
I reminded myself as I began to slow my breathing and clear my head. I then suddenly felt the walls of the tunnel begin to brush against my sides and back. I stopped for a second and realized that the tunnel was growing more and more narrow as I went on. Creature's screech echoed off of the tunnel walls.
It must have found the entrance.
I could hear its claws scraping just several feet behind me.
Well, there was no going back now. I sank to my stomach and began to army crawl forward as fast as I could. Soon it got to the point where I couldn't even fit my hands by my side anymore. In the pitch black, I couldn't see if I was heading toward a dead end or an exit. I could feel the creature behind me as its long antennae began to brush against the back of my legs. Oh, I was almost within reach. I squirmed forward, hand outstretched in front of me. My heart began to race as I suddenly noticed that there was water beginning to flow freely into the tunnel. It pulled quickly around me, and I found myself half submerged within seconds. I lifted my head back and drew in one final breath before the water went over my head. My body suddenly stopped as I felt the walls close in around me tightly. I was stuck. My lungs burned as the last of the oxygen was spent, and a searing pain shot through my body as one of the creature's claws dug into the calf of my leg. There was nothing else I could do. I closed my eyes and began to focus on slowing my heart down. Then, suddenly, I could hear the countdown. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Light suddenly erupted around me, and I sat up to the sound of cheers and applause. The dome above the bed I was lying in lifted, and I stood to my feet. I was standing on a stage, surrounded by cameras. There were several domes around me, but one of them empty. The only other occupied one contained a burly figure, who also stood to his feet. "Ladies and gentlemen," a voice boomed over the speakers, "I give you our final contestants." The game was simple. The contestants were to lie on their backs in what we referred to as the dome. While inside, we would be put into a coma-like state while small electrodes were gently placed on our temples and chests. The ones on our chests were attached to a Holter monitor, and the ones on our temples came from a neurostimulator, all done by professionals, of course. While inside the simulation, we would be put into several scenarios for 5 minutes at a time. Each scenario will be based on our worst fears. While inside the simulation, our heart rate will be closely monitored, and if it were to ever reach over 110.1 beats per minute, we will be forcefully ejected out of the simulation and automatically forfeit the match. The entire simulation will be projected on the big screen for the audience to watch from our point of view. If the contestant was ejected, the screen would fade to black, to the sound of a comical chicken clucking, echoing through the speakers, much to the amusement of the crowd. There were 9 levels altogether, 1 being silly childhood fears, and 9 being 5 minutes in actual hell. I remember the first one for me. I was standing in a dark basement of an abandoned building as hundreds of rats scampered across the floor around my feet. The occasional one darting up the side of my leg or leaping onto my sweat-stained body. This was a recurring nightmare I used to have, based on a childhood memory when I accidentally disturbed a rat's nest after being dared to go into the abandoned basement of my friend's house. Although the sight immediately made me uneasy, I didn't get as worked up as I'd expected. The simulations that proceeded went on as such. Walking through a pitch-black tunnel, strange whispers echoed across the walls. Climbing up a steep ladder so high off the ground I could barely see anything from above the clouds. Lying paralyzed as dozens of centipedes crept over my bare skin. Being stranded in the open ocean as dark figures circled me and occasionally nudged and tugged on my feet. All based on fears and phobias I used to have in the past. The dark. Heights. Centipedes and the open ocean. By the end of the 5th simulation, only 10 contestants remained who hadn't chickened out. The next ones were a little more than unsettling. They were downright gruesome. The 6th one, I found myself tied to a bed at a dingy hospital as doctors began to perform surgery on me while I was still conscious. I lied there paralyzed,
unable to move as I felt the scalpel dig into my soft flesh as they slowly made the incision. Oh, it all felt so real. The one after that, I found myself standing on a frozen lake with my niece who suddenly fell through the ice. As I ran to her aid, the hole that she'd fallen through immediately became frozen over as I began to pound the ice with my bare fists over and over again until my knuckles bled. The whole time watching her as she slowly sank further and further out of sight. Oof, that one nearly did me in. At first, it was embarrassing knowing that the audience had a full view of the simulations. The last few were very personal, but I tried not to let it bother me. I suffer from chronic scoliosis, which is a condition that causes a small curvature of the spine. Every 5 years or so, I need to undergo surgery to correct it, so I always dreaded hospitals and doctors. My niece was 6 years old when she drowned, after falling through the ice at a lake where my family used to enjoy ice skating during the winter. Oof, I felt violated afterward, like my worst fears and memories were suddenly opened up for the world to see for their entertainment. And yet, I still pressed on. After the 8th simulation, which played on my crippling claustrophobia, only me and one other contestant remained. His name was Ray, a supposedly fearless competitor who I believe used to serve as a Marine. I never knew I would make it this far, and my ability to control my heart rate and remain calm even in the most horrific circumstances surprised the audience just as much as it surprised me. Well, maybe those breathing techniques I'd learned while coping with my anxiety had come in handy. Or perhaps it was sheer will alone that helped me get by. After everything I've been through, all the failures and heartbreaks I'd endured, I was determined to win. I'd never been truly good at anything until I entered into this contest. Don't get me wrong, there were many things I was terrible at, but I always found myself as mediocre at best with everything I tried. Sports, schools, hobbies, I could never really find anything I truly excelled in. I was only ever truly good at one thing, up until now, that is. This was my one chance to prove myself that I had what it takes to show the world that I am a man without fear. I'm able to face my fears to win this contest. None of this is real, so nothing could truly hurt me, right? What did I have to lose? The crowd went wild as the host announced the final contestants who would face off in this final challenge. The 9th stage was unknown to everyone in the room, as only a few contestants had ever made it this far in previous seasons, and when they did, the simulation was made private so that the audience could not see it. The screens were blacked out for this simulation, showcasing only the words, "The Truth," to the live audience. As I entered the dome for the last time, I looked over to Ray, who gave me a confident yet sportsmanlike nod. As I was laid onto my back, the technician began to place the electrodes to my body, and I wondered what the final simulation could be. Would I be skinned alive by a masked serial killer? Would I be falling head over heels into a dark and endless pit? Or would I find myself face to face with me? Facing the truth that I am my own worst fear. My heart rate began to pick up as my mind raced through the possibilities. "Take it easy," I murmured to myself as I began to slowly inhale through my nose and exhale through my mouth. "You've got this," I told myself, and I felt myself slowly begin to drift away, ready to face the truth. Light flooded my vision. As my consciousness entered the simulation, I tensed up, ready for anything, expecting horrors beyond comprehension. My eyes darted about, taking in my surroundings. To my confusion, I discovered the complete opposite. I stood in the middle of a clearing, surrounded by lush vegetation. A gentle breeze blew through the branches, and the sun warmed my skin. I relaxed slightly and took in a deep breath. To my amazement, the air tasted sweet, and just the feeling of it inside my lungs filled me with a renewed energy I hadn't felt before. I took one step forward. my bare feet brushing across the soft grass. It was then that I noticed something completely different. The all-too-familiar dull ache in my lower back was gone. I slowly reached behind me and ran my hand down the small of my back. The skin was smooth. I felt no scar tissue from the countless surgeries I'd had. I placed my hands on my hips and leaned back slightly. There was no pain at all, not even the slightest bit of discomfort. Now, over the years, I'd grown almost accustomed to that pain, and this was the first time since I could remember that the pain wasn't there. Oh, it felt great. My mind raced. How was this possible? Did I die during the simulation? Was this the afterlife? I then noticed something else. I no longer felt the overbearing weight of my depression and anxiety. Negative thoughts and insecurities were no longer in the back of my mind. I couldn't recall a single bad feeling or painful memory at all. I felt a tear fall from my eye. I wasn't sad. I felt the complete opposite. For the first time in a long time, I genuinely felt happy. I felt at peace with myself and everything around me. With a burst of sudden energy, I found myself running out of the clearing and into the forest. My heart pumped faster as I felt a burst of adrenaline. I had never run like this before. As I ran through the forest, I took in all the beauty that surrounded me. The earth here was different. Different in a way I can't even describe. As I ran, the earth changed around me. One moment it was a lush forest with green leaves and colourful flowers. The next, I was on a mountaintop. I could see the clouds below me from where I'd sprinted as lightning and thunder lit them up in blinding flashes of blue lights. And the next, I was on a beach with cool water slashing around my ankles. Then, I was by a river, surrounded by towering waterfalls. The mist felt cool and refreshing on my skin as I continued to run, faster and faster than before. It was then that I found the entrance to a cave. I slowed down to a stop before I stepped inside. I don't know what caused me to go in. I felt like it was just calling to me, like there was something inside I was meant to see. As I walked forward, the light faded into complete darkness. I stopped suddenly as my hand brushed across the back of the cave. Turning around to head back, I was then surprised to see a dim light begin to fill the inside of the cavern. As I looked around me, I saw thousands of lights begin to pierce the darkness. Small, translucent glowworms covered the walls and the ceiling of the cave, their small lights shining like thousands of stars and galaxies. I just stood there, taking in the surrounding beauty. I felt like I was at the center of the universe. I felt like I was on top of the world. I felt like I was in heaven. I never wanted it to end. It was then I heard a distant voice. 50 seconds, the voice said. I snapped out of my trance and looked around me in confusion. One by one, the glowing lights began to fade out as the darkness began to creep back in.
40 seconds,
the voice said. The countdown, I thought to myself. I was still in the simulation.
30 seconds.
I heard it louder this time. My heart began to race as all of a sudden I felt panic begin to set in. No, I wasn't ready to leave. I wanted to stay here.
20 seconds.
The voice droned as the darkness began to creep closer and closer.
No, I shouted in fear. No, you can't take me back.
10 seconds,
the voice said indifferently.
No,
I screamed again as the last of the lights began to fade out.
I'm not ready to go back. Oh, you can't make me go.
The voice began to count down from 10 to 1. I reached out in desperation, trying to catch the last of the fading lights before it was snuffed out, but it was too late. I pounded against the cave walls with all my strength, screaming until my lungs felt raw, my heart pounding in my chest. After everything I'd been through, my worst fear was the thought of actually returning to reality. I sat up in a panic. I shielded my eyes as the lights from the stage blinded me temporarily. I felt a sharp pain as I sat up from my lower back. "And we have ourselves a winner," the voice of the announcer boomed through the speakers as the crowd got out of their seats and cheered. I began to sweat as the dream fully faded away and reality slowly sank in. All of my pain, my discomfort, all of my negative thoughts seemed to be amplified as I could barely stand up out of the dome. The air tasted bitter and smelled sour. The room was hot and muggy. The floor below my feet felt hard and uncomfortable. As the announcer stepped forward to congratulate me with an outstretched hand, I reached out and grasped him by the front of the shirt.
"Send me back," I begged him. "I wasn't finished yet."
"No, you weren't," he said, half laughing. "But you were seconds away from the 5-minute mark. That's a record."
"Don't you understand?" I shouted. "I can't take it anymore. Please send me back."
I began to wrap my hands around his throat in anger. I was then jerked back and was roughly put into a chokehold. I threw my head back in retaliation, feeling it collide with a burly security guard's face. His grip loosened slightly, and I fell face first onto the ground. The crowd began to murmur nervously as I scrambled toward the dome. I grasped the electrodes and clumsily began to try and stick them back onto my temples. It was then I felt a sharp pain shoot through my body as the guard fired his stun gun right between my shoulders. As my thrashing body hit the ground, I noticed movement from the other side of the stage. A group of medical staff and first responders crowded around Ray's dome. The last thing I remember before I passed out was Ray's lifeless eyes as they loaded his limp body onto a stretcher and began to rush him off the stage. The showrunners made a public statement shortly afterwards, publicly apologizing to the viewers and explaining that what they'd witnessed was not an effect of their machines. It was a mental breakdown due to my medical history. Ray was DOA when we reached the hospital. I overheard the doctor saying it was caused by a ventricular fibrillation during the simulation. For those of you without a medical degree, it means the Marine was scared to death. I was released a few days later. I received an apology letter from the executives of the show along with my prize money. They added a few zeros to the amount as compensation for any sort of trauma I might have experienced during the simulation. Well, I knew hush money when I saw it. Since that day, I feel like I live in constant agony. An agony every one of you feels every single day, but may not be aware of it. A pain you've grown all too accustomed to because it's all you ever know. A pain you only realize that exists when you've lived 5 minutes without it. You don't know the truth. Life is pain. Every second of our existence. Now I spend my days longing to return to that simulation. That place where pain does not exist and my mind is at ease. Sometimes in my dreams, I catch a glimpse of it for a few seconds before I'm quickly thrown back into consciousness. Well, I guess Gibran was right when he said, "Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding." October 2009. I purchased my first house during my 8th month of pregnancy. It was located in my hometown, a small, quiet place of maybe 2,500 people who never locked their doors. It was a cute, cottage-style, two-level home I'd purchased from a guy I'd gone to high school with. It had been in his family since the place was built, yet no one could really say exactly when that was. We decided to set up the nursery in the bedroom downstairs for obvious reasons, safety and convenience. The room was painted with three walls beige and one wall a deep maroon color. Despite the dark wall, the room was very bright and cheerful. The corner furthest away from the entrance was darker than the rest of the room. At first I thought it was because of the maroon and beige colors meeting in the corner. But even when the sun shone directly in the room, the corner looked pitch black. I decided to put a large dresser in the corner. Ooh, it gave me chills just to look at it. I just wanted it covered up. I was a first-time new mum. Everything had to be sterilized. So before moving anything in the room, I scrubbed and vacuumed the entire place. When I started to move the dresser to its assigned corner, a sharp pain ran at the bottom of my bare foot. To my astonishment, I'd stepped on a large piece of glass. The piece was thick. It looked like it came from a windshield. It even had the tempered coating. More large, thick pieces glistened along the floorboard. I moved the dresser only to find more pieces of broken glass. I couldn't believe it. I'd just thoroughly vacuumed this whole room not less than 24 hours before. If the glass was there, I would have gotten it. I checked the dresser from top to bottom, thinking the glass may have been dragged in with it. Since the glass was on the floor beneath one of the small windows, I thought maybe the window had been broken and replaced at one time. The pieces knocked loose off the sill, even though I'd washed it, when I moved the large dresser near the wall. Nothing. Nothing in that room hinted at where the glass could have come from. Once again, I vacuumed the entire carpet, taking great care to get the corners and along the floorboards. I finished setting the nursery up and went to make dinner. I began unpacking dishes, pots and pans, the usual. As I squatted down to put the pots away, I happened to glance up at the glass of the oven. The reflection revealed the bottom of a late 1800 lady's nightgown. Just as I realized what I was looking at, it felt as though someone bent over as to cover me. I felt arms wrap around my shoulders to keep me from falling back onto my rear end from the surprise. Then it felt as though whatever was bending over me fell over and went through my body. Like when a person leans too far forward and loses balance. I slowly sat fully on the floor for a long while in disbelief, stunned and confused. I was in a daze, trying to comprehend what I'd just experienced when my boyfriend came around the counter. He looked at the expression and immediately thought something had happened with the baby. He sat down on the floor with me and wrapped his arms around me, asking if I was okay. And this snapped me out of my stupor. I looked at him and told him what had just transpired. I knew that he didn't believe me. He just told me to go lay down. I must have been overtired from the move and being so close to my due date. He made dinner. We ate and went to bed. The next day, I was back in the nursery, putting baby clothes away, when I felt a searing pain go through my foot yet again. More glass. It was the same type as before, located in the same place. I couldn't believe it. Again, I moved all the furniture and vacuumed. I even vacuumed the window frame to make sure I got any that may have been left behind. I literally got down on my hands and knees to inspect the carpet for any remnants. Every little piece had been sucked up in the vacuum. I then called the friend I'd purchased the house from. I knew that the first floor of the house had been totally renovated in the months before the purchase. So I asked my friend if he'd had any problems with finding broken glass in the house. I made sure not to mention the bedroom specifically. There was one long pause before he responded, No, I've never found any broken glass on the floor. I certainly never found any in the dark corner of the bedroom. His response sent cold electricity down my spine. Beads of fear ran down my forehead, and my body stiffened like a statue. I quietly thanked him and hung up the phone. I couldn't do anything but stand there, wondering how the hell I found myself in this B-rated horror movie. November 2009. I gave birth to my beautiful daughter, Avalon, without complication. The father and I brought her home, and our new life as a family began. I would find more glass in the coming days and months. It appeared at random intervals. Sometimes I would have to vacuum several days in a row. Other times weeks would go by without any new discoveries. Each day, I would get up before the baby and inspect every millimeter of the carpet. As time went on, I started to notice that the feeling of the room became, well, different. The darkness in the corner became stronger, emitting a sense of danger and fear. Whenever I went into the room, it felt as though the air thickened and was then sucked out. The baby didn't seem to be bothered. She was always happy no matter where she was, so I thought maybe it was just my imagination. However, it came to a point where I felt dread just walking by the room. At night, the rest of the room looked normal, with some light trickling in from street lamps. It seemed as though the light from the street and the nightlight stopped abruptly just before the corner. Fortunately, the dresser hid most of it, but I could see the edges of the abyss peeking out. January 2010. I began sleeping downstairs on the couch, so I could keep an eye and ear on the baby. Then I started sleeping on her floor. I felt as though a madness was taking over me. The fear of a dark corner driving me insane. I always felt as though something terrible was in the corner, watching, waiting, taking refuge in the darkness. Some horrible creature was living in the shadow of that goddamn corner, and it was waiting for me to let my guard down. Perhaps it was leaving the glass for me to find. Perhaps the glass was part of it, falling off as it moved around like shedding skin. I knew the glass and the corner were connected. I just couldn't piece it together. March 2011. Avalon was now 16 months old and a force of nature in her own right. Her crib, playpen, safety gates, nothing could hold her untamed character. I was mother to the princess from the movie Brave meets Dennis the Menace. Never a dull moment, never. What I couldn't understand was how she would get out of her crib each time I would try to put her down. The crib was vintage. In order to slide down it, to make it easier to pick up or lay down, I would have to reach underneath the bottom of the front panel and push a lever that released the side. It was meant to be used with my foot, sort of a hands-free feature so I could keep both hands on the baby as I laid her down. Every time I walked into her room, she would be playing happily on the floor, the side of the crib lowered. I was still finding glass on a regular basis, so this was a big concern. By this time, the darkness had almost covered an area extending about 10 feet from the corner to the middle of the walls on either side. Our cats seemed to agree with me about the fear and dread emanating from the corner, and refused to go in the room, even though they would always flank Avalon wherever else she was in the house. It was pretty cute watching her with two furry bodyguards. One of the cats, Kilala, was a stray that had come trick-or-treating on Halloween in 2010 and got the treat of a new home. Oh, she was a beautiful cat. Her eyes were a deep, dark green. Her soft, luxurious fur was mostly white, with patches of tiger stripes. But her face was striking. Her muzzle was long and boxy, like a fox. Her ears were similar to a fox as well, long and slender with black tufts playfully sticking up at the tapered ends. Not only was she unique in looks, but her size was certainly a noticeable feature. 34 inches from the tip of her nose to the tip of her tail. 19 inches on the vertical measure. Add the extra long fur, and she was a sight to behold. After a checkup at the vet, we introduced her to our home, and then to Avalon. Key walked up to her, sat down directly to Avalon's right, and stayed there, motionless, like an Egyptian cat statue. That was her permanent post from that moment on. May 2011. My uncle had given Avalon a beautiful antique mirror, the type you would find on an old vanity table. I attached it to the wall in her bedroom so that she could make faces and admire herself as only a 16-month-old could. On cleaning day, I would hurriedly go into the room, do my chores, and, well, get the hell out of there. That day, as I cleaned up the room, I dropped a toy that rolled under the crib. I had to lay down flat to reach it. As I went to pick myself up off the floor, I happened to glance in the mirror. I don't know how long I laid there on my stomach, mouth agape, completely shocked at what I saw. The reflection of the dark corner in the mirror shimmered like the surface of a lake, small ripples of shadow softly floating to the edges, tendrils of darkness floating outwards like the tentacles of an octopus floating in the ocean. If it hadn't been such a source of fear, the image would have been one of serenity and calm. I pulled myself up into a sitting position, never taking my eyes off the mirror. I couldn't, and still can't, fathom what I was looking at. My entire life has been full of experiences, yet I couldn't comprehend what I'd witnessed in that mirror. After that, my fear of the dark corner was so immense that Avalon and I both started sleeping in the living room. Me on the couch, Avi in her playpen. I couldn't go in the bedroom after dark, and barely during the day. July 2011. Avalon and I had been terribly sick for a week. It started with her vomiting uncontrollably, and then the sickness spread to me. It had gotten to the point where, despite being ill myself, I slept on the floor right next to Avalon's bed. I was terrified that she would choke on her own vomit in her sleep. I'd just pulled my own head out of the hospital tub when I looked into the dark corner. The only light was coming from Avalon's small nightlight. As usual, the light stopped abruptly at the edge of the mass. But tonight, it was a bit different, more ominous and dreadful. I sat and stared at the corner until poor Avalon started puking in her sleep. Being 16 months old, she didn't have the awareness to wake herself up. I got up and brought the bucket over to her. When she was done, I emptied it, got a cold washcloth, water, and fresh PJs from the dryer. I walked groggily into the bedroom and dropped everything. Avalon was out of her crib, standing in front of her massive dresser with her back to me. She stood, silent, motionless, just at the edge of the light, just where the darkness started to creep, and stared into the corner. I slowly walked to her. In the state of sickness we were both in, I knew I didn't have the strength for any bullshit that night. I picked her up. She was cold and sweaty, just as a child as sick as she was should feel. It was a relief for the moment. I washed her up, changed her clothes and bed. She was silent. I tried to give her some water. Not a sound. Even though it was late and she was sick, Avalon was never silent. The border of the darkness in the corner moved out a few more inches as I sat on the floor with her in my arms and rocked her until morning. The day after Avalon and I made it over the sickness hump, she went to her grandparents' house for the day. Being so sick for a week, things were extra messy, so I decided to clean the house. It was time to pull the dresser out to check for glass and to size up the dark shadow in the corner. I was finally getting tired of this goddamn thing, and it was time for it to go. As I yanked on the edge of the large, heavy dresser,
I heard a sound come straight from the piece of furniture, like a rotting piece of wood being yanked off an old nail. Sort of half-screech, half-groan, but the dresser held fast. I stepped back to assess the situation. I stared hard at the corner, letting it know that I wasn't going to be deterred. I straightened my back, braced my feet, and proceeded to move that damn dresser. The noise started low and gained volume as I pulled the dresser away from the alcove. It crescendoed into almost a scream of unimaginable horror as I finally got the large piece of furniture away from the wall and into the middle of the room. And then, deafening silence. The corner, it seemed, sat contemplative. I felt silly, staring down at a shadow that really hadn't done anything except instill fear, sickness, and disbelief into my soul. For a moment, it just looked like a bright, sunny room with no ominous overtones. I stood there, wondering if I'd really imagined it all. As I was lost in thought, a twinkle of light caught my eye. It was another piece of glass. It was stuck halfway under the trim board. It was different from the previous pieces found. It was larger, had sharper edges, looked like a piece of volcanic glass. I turned the piece over in my fingers. As I turned to leave the room to add the piece to the collection, a pain shot up the back of my leg. Another black piece had found its way under the ball of my foot. I pulled it out, added it to the first piece, and began the short walk to the kitchen. Once again, pain. Another piece of black, shiny glass. It seemed that every step I took, another piece of glass appeared just beneath my foot. I stood there, scanning the floor for more pieces, yet the beige carpet was bare. Having been vacuumed each morning, there was little dust, dirt, or any other debris inhabiting the fibers. I slowly took another step, trying to see if anything would miraculously appear under my foot. As soon as my entire foot was placed on the floor, more pain. A piece of glass appeared only after I had completed each step. In very ungraceful-like manner, I made my way the 8 feet left to the door into the kitchen and grabbed the vacuum again. After doing the daily ritual of vacuuming the entire house, I once again entered the room. I stood in front of the corner, squaring off with it. I spoke to it out loud, as if it had been something living. Surely it would hear me. "Whatever the fuck you are, you need to leave me and my family alone. You are not welcome here. I don't want you messing with Avalon Dave or myself. If you make us sick again or hurt us in any way, I will burn down heaven and hell in order to make you suffer." And at this point, it wasn't an empty threat. Once crossed, I don't take kindly to letting things go. Hurt anyone I care about, well, it may take years, decades, but I will have my revenge. I moved the dresser to another point in the room. I wanted the corner opened in order to keep a closer eye on it. The noise I made when I moved it made me feel as though the shadow felt safer hiding behind something. I vacuumed again and went to the library to do some research. I spent hours trying to find anything about the entity in the corner. I couldn't find anything about dark spots and or glass. I researched the history of the house and of limestone, trying to find the lady in white. Nothing. Nothing. I went home, defeated. I walked into the house, around the corner, into the kitchen, and stopped at Avalon's bedroom door. I looked at the corner. "I will find a way to get rid of you, destroy you, get my house back, you son of a bitch." I continued upstairs and sat on the top step, something I did when I needed to think or get a moment of peace.
As I sat in thought, I felt a cold wind come from the opposite side of the room. The hair on the back of my neck and arms stood up. The pages of a magazine sitting on the floor near the bed fluttered. I looked around and saw nothing. The cats, who had been napping on the bed, shot up and ran downstairs. Kilala nuzzled my arm and climbed into my lap. I could still feel the cold swirl around us. She sat rigid, on my legs in her usual Egyptian cat stance, ears scanning independently, like little furry radars. She turned her head to look at the windows on the either side of the room. She scanned the area until both eyes and ears locked onto something. Her eyes followed it across the room, arched behind me, and then stopped. At that moment, the air was so cold I could see my breath. Something ran fingers through my ponytail and tugged at the back of my shirt. But I wasn't scared. Key wasn't freaking out, just observing. I sat staring dead ahead, pun intended. I tried to see out of the corner of my eye to catch something in the periphery of my sight. I looked to my left as much as possible, only to catch the lace and ruffles of a familiar dress. It was the lady in the white dress from the kitchen. Not daring to move, I looked up to catch a glimpse of her entire form. I could see as far up as her waist. That was all there was of her for me to see. She stepped down onto the staircase, and by her second step, she was gone. Key's eyes followed her the rest of the way down the stairs and into the kitchen, right up to the spot where I'd first encountered her. She then turned back to me and did her usual head bump and began to purr. We sat on the stairs, her sprawled in my lap, me rubbing her ears and tummy. September 2011. I tried to figure out what I was missing. Was the corner and the lady in the white dress connected? Did something happen to her in that room? Was she murdered and left in the corner? The only thing I could think that may help was to smudge the house with sage. It couldn't hurt, could it? It was better than doing nothing at all. The only problem, living in northern Maine doesn't allow for many specialty stops. That weekend, I made the 4-hour journey to a small shop in Augusta after speaking with a very helpful gentleman that owned it. Merkaba Sol was the usual little hippie metaphysical Tibetan supply shop that had shelves of crystals, tarot cards, Tibetan prayer flags, hemp clothes, and the like. After almost an hour of explaining my plight, receiving suggestions and instructions, I left with a large feather and a smudge stick. For those that don't know what that is, it's a cigar-shaped bundle consisting of white sage, sometimes lavender, and other cleansing plants. The feather is to direct the smoke as needed. The next day I brought Avalon back to my parents' house, waited for Dave to go to work, and began the sweep. I started upstairs. As instructed, I smudged the windows and windowsills, the door frames, and, for good measure, the entire damn room. I went room to room until the entire house was done. A smoky haze filled the air, and the smell of sage was overpowering. I got to Avalon's bedroom. I did the windows and the door leading out to the mudroom. The closet was next, and then the damn corner. Gee, that damn corner. I stood there, stick in one hand, feather in the other, squaring off like a showdown in an old western. I blew on the stick to get as much smoke as possible billowing out of it, and went to work. I started in the direct middle of the dark spot, concentrating as much smoke as possible into it. The spot lightened, but the edges stayed dark. I pulled back, and the spot became dark again. I tried it again,
pulling as much smoke as possible from the bundle and directing it towards the center of the shadow. Only this time I gave it everything I had. I kept the barrage of smoke going as long as I could, the shadow beginning to fade from the center out to the edges. About an hour later, the shadow was gone completely. The entire room, bright and sunny. I thought maybe this had done the trick, but I still had the feeling of dread and fear. I finished smoking out the entire house, opened all the windows to let the bad spirits out as instructed. Nothing felt different. No shadows throwing themselves out to get away from the cleansing smoke. No white lady appearing then disappearing with a thankful look of calmness to let me know she was able to leave this world. Nothing. Nothing but my neighbor walking up the driveway with a small bundle of fur in her arms. Before I'd begun the smudging, I put our cats outside. I saw them on the lawn giving me dirty looks through the upstairs windows. I'd woken them from a deep slumber, and they were not ready for their usual evening prowling. Smokey had continued his nap under some pine trees. Key wasn't far away, sitting in her guard cat position. Doom Kitty, from the show Ruby Gloom, went off to his usual visit for treats from the elderly couple nearby. After the smudging process, I saw them again as I opened windows. They'd never moved from their selected spots. From the time it took for me to walk down my very tiny staircase, across the kitchen and out the front door, my dear, sweet, brave little Kilala had died. My elderly neighbor found her laying by the tree she was sitting at moments before, Smokey and Doom meowing loudly next to her. She knew the cats very well. Just seeing Key in any position but her Egyptian cat guard pose was enough to raise concern. She'd picked her up and brought her to me as I walked out the door. For a moment I thought, oh no, Key got hit by a car. But when the neighbor explained to me what happened, all I could think of was, this is war. The cause of death was acute respiratory failure and myocardial infarction. She suffocated and had a heart attack at the same time. The vet just couldn't understand why a year-old cat that she deemed healthy less than 3 weeks prior could just die suddenly. A heart attack. Yes, it is possible in animals. And yes, it could happen just like that. However, it was usually brought about by excessive adrenaline. Both the neighbor and I had seen Key sitting under a tree just moments before her death. Not terrified in fear or running crazily around the yard. Just sitting there, doing what she did best. And what about the suffocation? The vet shook her head, looked over her notes, reread the lab results. How could an animal suffocate with no obstructions in her breathing passages? No medical issues to speak of. Nothing. Nothing. There was so much nothing going on. I felt like I was in the never-ending stories. Apologies for that. I'm the type to make bad jokes at funerals. I guess it's a coping mechanism. January 2012. It was back to the library for more research. I looked up shamanic recipes for cleansing the soul, spirit animals, spirit stones, spirit flowers, crystals for cleaning chakras, binaural beats, meditation music, Gregorian chants, African drum beats, candle colors, prayers in every language and religion. I found every possible bit of information regarding cleansing that was available. I filled a notebook with what I thought I may need, made my list of weapons, and headed back to Augusta. I came home with an arsenal. Spent about a week familiarizing myself with each and every rock, plant, prayer, chant, and color that I'd purchased. When I felt I was ready, I made sure that Dave and Avalon would be out of the house for at least the weekend. This was something I needed to do alone. Dave was a disbeliever, and I didn't want anything else bad to happen to Avalon. Seeing her sick was enough for me. The two remaining cats went to a friend's house. I didn't know if having everyone as far away as possible would protect them, but I had to try. Finding myself alone in the house again, I set about constructing an altar of sorts in the corner. White candles lined the walls. Incense in the smudge stick sat in the middle. Various crystal stones were strewn about. A bowl of holy water to my right. An athame to my left. I laid out the prayers and incantations in front of me and went to work. As I sat down, I felt silly again. I looked about the items and wondered if I'd really just let my imagination get the best of me. I sat, eyes closed, and thought about all the previous experience I'd had throughout my entire life. After a few minutes, my resolve strengthened, and I knew the instinctual feelings swirling about my innards were correct, and that this had to be done. I poured a circle of salt around the altar. This was to create a circle of protection. I sprinkled holy water over everything, lit the white candles, incense and smudge stick, positioned the crystals in a semicircle, sat cross-legged, and began the first protection prayer. As I spoke the words out loud, I heard a faint screeching sound, like car tires coming from down the street. It grew louder as I spoke more of the prayer. Like when I tore the dresser from the wall, it turned into a howling roar. I continued the praying as a cold breeze picked and swirled around me. The howling became echoish, like it was coming from an old-time radio. I kept my eyes closed and the words going. I was terrified inside, but I couldn't let it surface. I can laugh a bit about it now, but it was almost like the Ark opening scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark. I kept my posture rigid, head up, back straight, legs crossed, hands on my knees. I was coming to the end of the prayer, and I knew I would have to open my eyes to read the next set of notes. In hindsight, I probably should have memorized everything. But when your house kills your cat, the small details are easily overlooked. I finished the prayer, and the howling started to die down, and the breeze warmed. I knew I couldn't stop, or else something worse might happen. Too terrified to open my eyes, I felt around for the vial of holy water, sprinkled everything around me again, and began the only prayer I knew somewhat by heart, the Lord's Prayer. I spoke loudly and angrily, corralling all the negative energy and events that had happened so far. I used the negativity to my advantage. As I spoke, my tone was as threatening as possible. I used the prayer as bullets. I finished the prayer, opened the vial again, and splashed the entire thing at the wall. Then I began the prayer again. Speaking as though I was in a fight and throwing insults, I kept the thoughts of the past circulating in my head, using them as fuel to get myself worked into a murderous frenzy. I wanted to make the fear dissipate altogether. I wanted whatever it was in that corner to fear me as I had feared it. I was screaming by now, just repeating the Lord's Prayer over and over. I couldn't hear the howling over my own voice. The anger inside numbed me to the cold breeze. I just kept going, raising to my feet, clenching my fists, screaming at the top of my lungs. The entire time, my eyes were closed. Images of the dark corner shone brightly behind my eyelids. The shadow kept contorting, like looking into a sadistic kaleidoscope. I don't know how much time had passed before I finally fell to my knees, exhausted. I slowly opened my eyes to see the shadow in the corner. It was about the size of a dessert plate, edges pulsating in a starburst. This made me as angry as ever before. Hatred and revenge swelled up in me. I was literally so mad, I didn't know what to do. I looked around at my arsenal. The holy water was depleted. Candles burned down. Incense long gone. Knowing I didn't have much time before the shadow began regaining its own strength and exacting revenge as before, I ran upstairs, grabbed a small Bible I'd gotten when in basic training, ran back to the corner and placed the Bible on the wall. A small moan shook the room. Leaning the book against the wall, I ran back to the kitchen, grabbed a roll of duct tape, went back into the bedroom and taped the Bible right over the center of the shadow. When you're short on time, you gotta do what you gotta do. I ran out to my truck, tore out of the driveway, spitting rocks and squealing tires. I got to the grocery store, bought as many 1 gallon waters as I could carry, threw them into the truck and tore off to the church. The priest met me with concern. I must have looked like a crazy person, arms full of gallon jugs, eyes wide, face red, carrying on about how I needed him to bless me and the water. Since I'd spoken to him before about my predicament, I was able to quickly give him the short explanation. He'd refused to come bless the house before, thinking me overly dramatic. It was probably for the best anyway. God knows what revenge would have been exacted on my family for that. Telling him that I would return to explain every little detail as soon as I could, I begged for him to fulfill my request of blessings. He said his little prayers, motioned with his hands, and was done with this crazy woman in his church. I pulled into the yard sideways, snow, rocks, and dirt flying, and ran into the house. I hadn't even bothered to close the doors when I left. I stopped inside the front door. It was as though time had slowed down. The house creaked and groaned. I stood and listened for a minute. It almost felt like I was an old ship at sea. The floor seemed to rise and fall, as though the waves were slowly rocking the house back and forth. I finally lost my shit, I thought out loud. I'm on the crazy boat to hell. I watched the pictures on the wall for movement. Fortunately, they stayed still. Nothing in the house seemed to be pitching back and forth, as if it were really on a boat, and yet, the floor felt like it was swaying back and forth. I tried to walk into the bedroom. It was like walking along the floor in a funhouse, on top of boards that shifted back and forth or up and down, trying to throw kids off balance. The floor didn't move. It was my perception of the floor that was throwing me off. I held tight to the water jugs and made my way into the bedroom. The Bible was still taped to the wall, edges of shadow poking around it. I tore it off the wall, opened a jug of water and began pouring the entire thing down the corner and along the walls. The ship stopped swaying. I picked up the second jug in one hand, opened the Bible with the other. Not knowing where to start, I turned to the first page of Genesis and began to read. At this moment, I had no plan. I was going on some sort of primal instinct. The Lord's Prayer and holy water seemed to work the best, so I stuck with this form of battle. As I read about what God did on the seventh day, I poured water in the corner and along the walls. The ship tilted sharply to starboard, and I almost lost my balance. But I kept reading. The howling and chilly breeze started again, so I closed my eyes and began letting myself get angry again. I kept reading. Kept getting angrier and angrier. This thing had made my daughter sick, killed my cat, and made me live in fear. It pushed me too far, and now it was my turn. I felt the hatred, anger, and revenge spring up from my soul once again. I worked myself into a frenzy of screaming words from the Bible and pouring water into my hand to whip it at the walls. The ship pitched starboard, and then to port. I struggled to keep my balance. I think the only thing that kept me upright was knowing that it was a matter of perception. I knew the shadow was messing with me. The house stayed still. The crazy boat was sailing. I kept reading, kept splashing, but I was getting weak. Now it was a matter of who would outlast the other. I threw the book on the floor, poured water into both hands and started painting the corner with it. Some sick, twisted form of finger painting. The walls were freezing, like sticking my hands onto a metal bar in the freezer. When my hands hit the wall, A wail of anger thundered through the house. Still screaming, I spoke of God getting rid of the beast and protecting my family. I felt like an evangelist going under the power. I repeated this over and over, again losing track of time. Just when I thought I couldn't do any more, I gained a second wind and kept going. The shadow would spread out across the walls, shrink into nothing, spread out again, shrink again. By this time I was shouting profanities, telling it to get out of my house and praying. The walls, floor, and myself were all soaked with holy water. I knew I couldn't stop until this thing was gone for good. My family and I were in big trouble if I didn't. I had one last idea. I ran to my jewelry box and grabbed an old rosary and cross. They belonged to my grandmother and had been blessed so many times, Jesus himself knew the objects well. Back in the bedroom, I hung the cross up on a little nail in the same spot I'd taped the Bible. Now that I think about it, why was that little nail in the exact spot I needed it to be? Had it been there all along? I really don't remember. I wrapped the rosary around my wrist, grabbed another jug of water and the now soaking pages of the Bible, and started again. I never let the anger waver or the fear surface. I just let myself be mad, taking every frustration out on that damn shadow. The ship still listed back and forth. The house creaked and groaned. I stumbled a few times, but never fell. I kept going like a marathon runner. In one last stand, the shadow swallowed the corner and adjacent walls in mind-altering blackness. The howling neared a glass-breaking pitch, and the house felt like it was going to cave in on me. Still screaming, I was down on my knees, hands planted on the floor. Yes, I was still on the crazy boat. Everything swayed and swirled around me. I felt myself faltering. And then, silence. Once again, nothing. I couldn't do anything more. So I laid down and either passed out or just fell asleep. I awoke. I didn't know if hours, days, or just seconds had passed by. Everything was still, quiet. I could hear birds, cars, kids playing outside. I sat up. The room was a mess. Empty water jugs all over. Candles, gemstones. Notebook pages were splayed all over the floor. The Bible was on the floor next to me. The rosary still around my wrist, and the cross was up on the wall. I stared at it for a moment. Had I gotten rid of the shadow? The prior events came into mind, and I stood up quickly, trying to figure out a new game plan. My thoughts raced as to what I should do next. I grabbed the Bible and a half-full jug of holy water. As I went to start my siege once again, I noticed a flutter of white. Out of the corner of my eye, just outside the door of the bedroom, was the bottom corner of a white lace dress. I turned to look at it straight on, but it disappeared. I turned back to throw water into the corner, but paused. The corner was light. The whole room had a sunny glow to it. There was no feeling of dread, fear, or hatred. I even felt happy. Not sure what to do, I cleaned up the bedroom, left the cross and rosary hanging on the wall, and went to get my family. March 2012. We moved out of the little house. Business transfer. Funny thing is, I never put in for one. Was something trying to get rid of me? My pay was doubled, and I couldn't say no to the perks. I almost hated leaving the house. I still own it, and people have rented it without incident. The cross and rosary are still hanging in the corner. I've told my renters that they were free to remove it, but I'm told that it makes them feel secure. Perhaps it all really wasn't my imagination. And so once again, we reach the end of tonight's podcast. My thanks, as always, to the authors of those wonderful stories, and to you for taking the time to listen. Now, I'd ask one small favor of you. Wherever you get your podcast from, please write a few nice words and leave a 5-star review, as it really helps the podcast. That's it for this week, but I'll be back again same time, same place, and I do so hope you'll join me once more. Until next time, sweet dreams and bye-bye.